New England towns stands a rusty wooden house with seven acutely peaked gables facing towards various points of the compass and a huge clustered chimney in the midst. So begins the second novel written by Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Hello, my name is Matt Leck. You're listening to Literary Hangover with me, Alex Guns.
Hello.
Today we are talking about Nathaniel Hawthorne's 1851 novel, The House of the Seven Gables. Not the first Nathaniel Hawthorne story we've done.
Not by a long shot.
Not even the second. We've done a number of them. It is my favorite, I think, by a long shot. I really enjoyed this book. It's very gloomy and sort of mysterious, but I think very layered and political, even though Hawthorne is the sort of great depoliticizing author. What did you think about it?
Yeah, I think reading this in context of the multiple other episodes we've done on him and his work, we've touched on these themes that Hawthorne circled around, and I feel like in House of the Seven Gables he's able to iron out these ideas in a much better way, even than Scarlet Letter that he released a year before this. These ideas of symbols and change and inheritance, he was able to get a real nuanced, complex take on it. And yeah, I would probably say this is maybe my favorite one that we've read of his so far.
This is the setting of this is a bit complicated, so it's meant to be
70 years after the country's founded.
Okay. And but there's flashback, and a lot of the past that they're dealing with goes back to the 17th century and the Puritans and Colonel Pynchon, and we'll get to him in a little bit. To give us a little bit of a historical background, I'm going to be referring to an article by David Grant of Washington State University called The Death of Anti-Whiggery in the House of the Seven Gables. First, I'll start reading out at length from some of the opening paragraphs. Speaking of the House of Seven Gables, Grant writes, because its villain is a scheming politician, this later novel, my focus here, has invited a more biographical and topical approach, often involving the period's political figures. Thus, a very recent article by James A. Cook argues convincingly that the novel exacts Hawthorne's satirical revenge on a Whig enemy, Charles W. Upham, just as earlier critics have taken the character Jaffrey Pynchon as standing in for other Whig officials such as Nicholas Biddle or Nathaniel Silsby, who had earned Hawthorne's scorn. This critical tradition of focusing on Hawthorne's concrete satirical purpose comports well with those facets of political life to which the novel limits itself. The House of the Seven Gables seems to deal with the mere epiphenomenon of the nation's politics, the false representations, empty pageantry, and relentless careerism that reduce party politics to a surface spectacle that eludes the deeper challenges the period offered to the reigning faith in American progress. The novel's meditations on historical continuity and the dead hand of the past seemingly occur on a different stage altogether from these tawdry performances. If the House of the Seven Gables represents decadent party politics, that is because the novel, I propose, forecasts what at a deeper level it also promotes, the collapse of the second party system whose resilience prevented conservative Northerners from coalescing against the new anti-slavery threat. Later on, Grant goes on, literary critics have shown how both The Scarlet Letter and The House of the Seven Gables support Hawthorne's conservative democratic opposition to emerging anti-slavery forces, which demanded that the nation take history into its own hands by actively confronting the retrogressive forces embodied in the power of slavery. Michael T. Gilmore has paraphrased this critical consensus when he addresses Hawthorne politics. Quote, Hawthorne regarded idealistic political action as an arrogation of God's power to dispose of human affairs when and how he saw fit. Elks, you read this article. What were some of your thoughts about it?
Well, it reminded me of other critical writings of Hawthorne. We talked a lot about his issue with slavery and how he lined up with the Jeffersonian idea that slavery is a natural act, and to interfere with that is like the height of arrogance, basically. And that's kind of his moral out for defending and upholding slavery. Mm-hmm. You can see that worldview. What was frustrating, was easy to write him off when we first were reading him, is like, well, that's a really bad cover for exploitation. And it still is. But in this novel, it becomes more than a cover and is like an entire worldview, like a systematic worldview for like how nature operates and how you don't have to try to bend the will of even your own circumstances is like extremely arrogant in Hawthorne's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to let fate kind of run its own course.
It's almost like witchcraft.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it's like we're all controlled in Hawthorne's universe. We're all controlled basically by forces that we can't understand. Mm-hmm. And to try to imitate that is like the height of absurdity, which I think he kind of places in what would be like necromancy. And then later on in wiggery almost like you think you can control your own destiny. It's so like disgusting to him.
Yeah. And later on, Grant goes on and I think gives maybe the one of the best summaries of how, you know, we now see our understanding of the Democrat Party, to use the right wing's term for it, was like they were the slavers' party, right?
Yeah.
In the 19th century. There's a section here that sort of explains how they genuinely felt that they were the anti, while that was true, they were, you know, fighting like basically like support of being able to hold slaves. It was also an anti-aristocratic thing too, which is, I think, helps understand how they justified it to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, later on, Grant writes, "The Democratic Party's self-representations depended on conspiracy, whereas the Whigs' progressivism rested on specific policies geared toward moving the nation forward in an ordered and steady evolution that would fulfill the revolution's promises through both personal and public development. Democrats, even when in power, saw their task as preservative and oppositional." In his canonical study of democratic ideology, Marvin Myers accounts for this mission in a useful formula. "Jacksonians saw the nation's polity as a whole body, the sovereign people, beset with aristocratic sores. The Democrats were dedicated to preventing these sores from overwhelming the body politic and thereby returning the nation to pre-revolutionary social patterns. In practical terms, this mission involved resisting the measures that would allow the old retrogressive forces of combined interest to overwhelm an unfolding Republican equality's impetus, and for all events and purposes, prevent what would otherwise be a fulfillment of democratic promise. In short, to take an active role in overthrowing and disabling true Republicanism's residual enemies. As the Democrat General Dix put it as the Whig Party was just emerging, because, quote, the principles of aristocracy are as deeply sealed here as under systems far less liberal in spirit and form. Republican institutions can be maintained only by perpetual struggle to maintain them. To Democrats, the principal historical truth that Whigs aimed to disguise was the continuity between their own program and that of the nation's old, discredited conservative party, the Federalists. Since that defunct party had more or less openly avowed its aristocratic principles and its qualms about the people holding the instruments of power, the charge of Federalism had a particularly sharp bite. The Democratic slur brought together a critique of aristocratic aims with a denunciation of dishonest communication to the people. Thus, Democratic orations consistently concerned themselves less with the folly of Whig policy positions than with the antecedents that they revealed to a people who did not let the distorting lens offered by modern customs to fool them." And then he goes on, finally, "The national election where the long-brewing Democratic disgust at Whig stratagems culminated was the famous 1840 Log Cabin Whig campaign, during which Hawthorne conceived the germ of the House of the Seven Gables." And so this was like the William Henry Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
And it later mentions about how the Democratic discourse of debunking impinged into Hawthorne's style a little bit. And it's funny because it didn't work for them then either, debunking. But
yeah, that's true.
So yeah, debunking. Not if you're debunking, you're probably not winning.
Yeah, it's yeah. Well, it's a whole mistake of why people have their political beliefs, which is, you know, not usually it's not from some reasoned place, but rather some long series of personal experiences and biases that build them up to one emotional connection with something, rather than like, oh, I'll let go of this thing that I've dedicated my identity to if I just get the right fact checker on it.
Yeah, it's far more social than factual.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that sort of continuity where the Whig is actually just the old animating force of the Federalists carrying on into the modern day. Hawthorne, there's another essay I read. We won't go into deeply here. We'll get out into the story, but that Jaffrey Pynchon, the villain of the story, not to spoil anything too much, that Judge Jaffrey Pynchon was based on Upham. This was actually mentioned in what I just quoted. He was responsible for getting Hawthorne booted from the Custom House. He helped to propagandize.
We're back at it. He just like finishes one book and it's a hit, and he goes, "All right, now it's back to how I'm really fucking pissed off."
Yeah, he went back for a double dip on that whole Custom House thing. I'm not mad I got kicked out of public office. And anyway, public office is bad. I don't even.
Yeah.
It makes me feel uncreative.
Yeah. Well, it's just like, you know, I feel like in Hawthorne's work, there's a lot of people from either beyond the grave or in old age giving warning. And there's something about like warning and how do you live your life. And there's something about his work of like, it stands as a really great testament to no matter how successful you get in your personal aims, you're still going to be a petty bitch about a lot of stuff.
Oh yeah.
Definitely. It's like not going to, it's never going to ease up. You're going to be the same person. It's like thinking about how you got fired from a cushion job 15 years earlier.
This is where write about what you know really comes into play, right?
Yeah.
Like how a personality can interact with sort of public office. Like he was a Customs House official for like many, many years. That was his main job.
And not the job he wanted also, just like a cushy job so he could work on his writing.
Yeah. Gets a good amount of cash.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is weird the way the politics have sort of morphed over time. In a way they seem more coherent now than they did then. Mainly because slavery was dealt with. I feel like was part of it. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
Yeah. You know, when I think about, I feel like a very quick shorthand is, you know, when people talk about the past, it's like the American past. It's like, well, by Democrat, you know, like they're Republican now, or it's like it's switched. And like, that's a good shorthand for, I don't know, like if you're not even at this point in 1851, like 1860, maybe there's like something there, but not a lot. Yeah. And this is a great example, like that article of like what drove this antebellum Democratic Party. It's something that's almost unfathomable now. Well, I guess you could probably put it in like kind of like a vague libertarian sort.
Yeah.
But this like Jeffersonian impulse for like to be the most loose confederation of like yeoman farmers that has no inheritance, that has like no chance to build anything, that you erase everything once you die and just start over, was like this core Democratic value. And that no party is saying that. It's not even a political opinion now.
Yeah, no.
Basically.
That, yeah, especially Holgrave. He says things that are just so like radical. We'll get to that in a little bit. But speaking of radical, the preface of this, I wanted to play a big chunk from, because I think it just encapsulates some very timeless wisdom, I will say. So we'll get to this here. This is from the preface of The House of the Seven Gables. And because we're playing so much of... so much of this narration, I should probably mention who the reader is. And that would be, this is read by Anthony Heald. This is not from Audible.
Many writers lay very great stress upon some definite moral purpose at which they profess to aim their works. Not to be deficient in this particular, the author has provided himself with a moral. The truth, namely, that the wrongdoing of one generation lives into the successive ones, and divesting itself of every temporary advantage becomes a pure and uncontrollable mischief. And he would feel it a singular gratification if this romance might effectually convince mankind, or indeed any one man, of the folly of tumbling down an avalanche of ill-gotten gold or real estate on the heads of an unfortunate posterity, thereby to maim and crush them until the accumulated mass shall be scattered abroad in its original atoms. In good faith, however, he is not sufficiently imaginative to flatter himself with the slightest hope of this kind. When romances do really teach anything or produce any effective operation, it is usually through a far more subtle process than the ostensible one. The author has considered it hardly worth his while, therefore, relentlessly to impale the story with its moral, as with an iron rod, or rather, as by sticking a pin through a butterfly, thus at once depriving it of life and causing it to stiffen in an ungainly and unnatural attitude. A high truth, indeed, fairly finely and skillfully wrought out, brightening at every step and crowning the final development of a work of fiction, may add an artistic glory, but is never any truer and seldom any more evident at the last page than at the first. The reader may perhaps choose to assign an actual locality to the imaginary events of this narrative. If permitted by the historical connection, which, though slight, was essential to his plan, the author would very willingly have avoided anything of this nature. Not to speak of other obligations, it exposes the romance to an inflexible and exceedingly dangerous species of criticism, by bringing his family pictures almost into positive contact with the realities of the moment. It has been no part of his object, however, to describe local manners, nor in any way to meddle with the characteristics of a community for whom he cherishes a proper respect and a natural regard. He trusts not to be considered as unpardonably offending by laying out a street that infringes upon nobody's private rights, and appropriating a lot of land which had no visible owner, and building a house of materials long in use for constructing castles in the air.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shots fired on Cooper and some other writers, possibly, that can't help but underline the moral and the theme of their novel. And I don't know, maybe you would know, but I don't know what like Hawthorne's syllabus was at this time, but I can't help but feel he's taking a page from French writers at the time, French novelists at the time, mm-hmm. that were really interested in covering people as they are in everyday life, and that was in itself interesting without necessarily underlining social moral.
Yeah, that'd be like Balzac and Flaubert.
Yeah, I think Balzac, it's either, I was trying to remember if it's Balzac or Flaubert, yeah. But it's one of the more famous idioms is that the job of the writer is not to change the world, but to understand the world, mm-hmm. which then Karl Marx later flips on its head.
Oh, yeah. Is that where Marx got it from?
I don't know if he got it from them, but it's literally the same dictum in reverse, or then turned on its head. So yeah. I don't know if he must, I would assume so.
I mean, I couldn't help, it's impossible not to think of how many children of inheritance that are on the world stage and how they've fucked up the planet, basically, when you read about that. Like, it's one thing for it to just make everyone in the family miserable. Mm-hmm. That's not what, for instance, the Bush family has done to the world, right?
Yeah.
I just want to draw attention to a specific part of that. Of the folly of tumbling down an avalanche of ill-gotten gold or real estate on the heads of an unfortunate posterity, thereby to maim and crush them until the accumulated mass shall be scattered abroad in its original atoms. And I wonder if this is sort of like the, like, there must have been like Democrats that were annoyed that slavery, like Hawthorne's position was sort of, slavery's bad, but it has to take care of itself.
Right.
But you're sort of blaming the inheritance of slavery then, right? Like, that's sort of like something you're inheriting, and you're just gonna, it's like it's treating it as like a sort of curse.
Yeah Or I feel like for someone like Hawthorne, they like, in and this maybe not necessarily Hawthorne, but this person who espouses this worldview at this time, to say that we need to get rid of slavery, for them they'd be like, well, like, that's like saying we need to get rid of flooding or something. Like, it's, they'd be like, it's not possible.
Which is the conservative response to a lot of things, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, and that is going to be that's how conservatives respond to climate change, literally.
Yeah.
Like, just sell your house.
Oh, yeah. You don't think that they wouldn't just pick up and move?
If it does happen, the rate they say it's going to, it's supposed to happen over the course of the next 100 years. So let's say, for the sake of argument, that all of the water levels around the world rise by let's say, 5 feet over the next 100 years, say 10 feet by the next 100 years, and it puts all the low-lying areas on the coast underwater, right? Which, let's say all of that happens. You think that people aren't going to just sell their homes and move?
Do you know how real estate again? I mean, the themes of real estate, I mean, here, let's just list off some of the themes that we can think of. There's real estate, there's inheritance, there's witchcraft.
Curses.
Yeah, there's jail and how that changes a person.
Yeah.
But let's get a little bit into this. This next part is from chapter one, and it describes the House of the Seven Gables is a house that was built by Colonel Pynchon way back in the Puritan days, 1600s. So, and this is just sort of where the original curse comes from, which is basically that Colonel Pynchon accuses Matthew Maule, I believe is the original Maule, of being a wizard. Basically to take his property. So again, a very woke take on the witch trials.
I think maybe even better, even in that passing moment, a more precise critique of the event than even the Scarlet Letter.
Yep. Yeah, I think so.
But this guy, he already had a lot of property and he wanted to get like one more acre right next to him. And that was Matthew Maule's like shithole that he was living in.
Yeah. And it's interesting, before I play this, there's two different passes that Hawthorne takes over the witch trials. There's the one up front here. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other one that takes place in Holgrave's story about Gervais Pynchon and Alice. And in that one, he says they got a little bit out of hand. And this time there is a little bit more,
maybe the strangest part of that book. Well, second strangest.
Yeah. Is Jaffrey, is that the strangest?
The chapter where he's just, where the narrator's, yeah. Yeah. Where he's just shitting on him. Okay, we'll get to it.
Old Matthew Maule, in a word, was executed for the crime of witchcraft. He was one of the martyrs to that terrible delusion, which should teach us, among its other morals, that the influential classes, and those who take upon themselves to be leaders of the people, are fully liable to all the passionate error that has ever characterized the maddest mob. Clergymen, judges, statesmen, the wisest, calmest, holiest persons of their day, stood in the inner circle round about the gallows, loudest to applaud the work of blood, latest to confess themselves miserably deceived. If any one part of their proceedings can be said to deserve less blame than another, it was the singular indiscrimination with which they persecuted not merely the poor and aged, as in former judicial massacres, but people of all ranks, their own equals, brethren, and wives. Amid the disorder of such various ruin, it is not strange that a man of inconsiderable note like Maule should have trodden the martyr's path to the hill of execution almost unremarked in the throng of his fellow sufferers.
I just want to note, that is a sociologically fairly woke take on the witch trials. That was what eventually caused it to maybe flame out, as it started going after members of the elite. I forget what her name was, but the witch in Scarlet Letter. Can you remember what her name was? She's
This is so embarrassing.
She's what's her name? Yeah, Bellingham's sister. Was it Mistress Hutchins or Miss?
No.
Oh, Mistress Hibbins. And actually, she was based on, if I'm not mistaken, the real like upper class woman that got targeted, and that everyone's like sort of whoa. The thing that this might sort of miss that should be stressed is, generally speaking, it was women that were targeted, and the most common were especially widows who stood to inherit property.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, a woman's going to be in charge of this estate now. Let's be suspicious about her.
So I couldn't help by reading the book, noticing like the anachronism that all the people who practice witchcraft are men in this book. And it must be Hawthorne's like way of getting around the fact that they're like property holders, that Matthew Maule like owned property. Like, it would be impossible to make him like a female character, basically. Mm. But if it was like an elderly woman who was inheriting property, it could have worked.
Right.
And I couldn't figure out why he made that choice other than that.
Yeah. I mean, I think you could look at a lot of pretty much every character in the book, besides maybe Phoebe, as being somewhat supernatural. Like there's maybe unconsciously so. There's a few things with Hepzibah that seem a bit... Hawthorne will just have these sort of asides where they're like... He even like literally calls Clifford a ghost or like a ghost sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think if they're not producing magic, they're being moved in some supernatural way.
And we've talked a lot about the sort of double register of writers go in terms of supernaturalisms, which is like writing books that can be enjoyed by people who believe in it and people that don't at the same time. Uh-huh. I think this is maybe the best example of that, where it's so subtle and can be so dismissed, but it actually, like, I've read some pretty crazy like interpretations of this book where like Hawthorne's hidden a story of Clifford drowning in it. And it's bizarre. I don't really buy it. I think the guy was a bit wacky. It was
There is something to be said, like reading this, that it picks up about at least I counted like five or six different plots to like, to then it goes along that way. And then just, it'll leave them. Like it just leaves the store plot.
Yeah.
That took over 50, 60 pages mm-hmm. in the original and then just kind of drops up. That's the kind of stuff, like it still works well together because the themes are strong enough. But I feel like if you pick up a lot of like threads and leave them, that is like fodder for people who want to make their own like secret narrative out of a book.
Right. There's a bit more of the witchcraft pretext.
But in after days, when the frenzy of that hideous epoch had subsided, it was remembered how loudly Colonel Pynchon had joined in the general cry to purge the land from witchcraft. Nor did it fail to be whispered that there was an invidious acrimony in the zeal with which he had sought the condemnation of Matthew Maule. It was well known that the victim had recognized the bitterness of personal enmity in his prosecutor's conduct towards him, and that he declared himself hunted to death for his spoil. At the moment of execution, with the halter about his neck, and while Colonel Pynchon sat on horseback grimly gazing at the scene, Maule had addressed him from the scaffold and uttered a prophecy, of which history as well as fireside tradition has preserved the very words. "God," said the dying man, pointing his finger with a ghastly look at the undismayed countenance of his enemy, "God will give him blood to drink."
Now, I don't remember how we cited this in the earlier time, but it's actually a myth that this is that was spoken to Hawthorne's relative. It was spoken to a different, member of the witch trials. But it is true. The I'm no more it was a woman that originally spoke it. I can't remember what her name was, but she said, "I'm no more a witch than you or a wizard, and if you put me to death, God will give you blood to drink. And apparently that guy actually did die of something sort of like this, to foreshadow, you know, what's going to happen in this. Well, actually, we won't actually play a clip from this, but Colonel Pynchon did die of apoplexy, which is basically just blood rushing out of wherever.
It's normal. It's a normal way to die in the 17th century.
I love like to match up previous, like what do they call it? Like all these old timey sorts of maladies.
Oh yeah.
And
like the four humors.
Yeah, exactly.
You have too much blood.
Well, yeah, he had too much blood in his mouth and died. And there's a number of different deaths. I don't want to spoil too much up front, but so let's actually get to Hepzibah Pynchon, who is the occupant of the House of the Seven Gables. Basically,
she didn't grow up there. She's lived there for the last 30 years since her brother Clifford had been incarcerated. And the crime supposedly is that he murdered his uncle, Jaffe Pynchon, who his son...
Jaffrey Sr.
Yeah, Jaffrey, that's right. Looking for... this like deed to more land.
To eastern lands. I've seen either Massachusetts or Maine mentioned. Yeah. There's this tale of this old deed to lands back from colonial times that probably won't be honored by any sort of court, but it lives on in the family, which I think this is sort of the stereotype of the family of an aristocratic lineage is the relative way back that's going to come for them back from India with riches or back with this deed that gives you a castle or some shit like that.
Well, it's interesting because it's reading Hawthorne's pre-colonial work, the ebb and flow cultural exchange between England and the colonies is very real. And now you see these characters who their glory is all tied up in a trade that no longer exists, like a cultural trade that's been severed because of the revolution. And now they're withering and they're dying on the vine.
Withering on their sort of capital investments.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
A house, basically, like what you were able to buy from that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so Hepzibah's living in the House of Seven Gables.
It's 200 years later.
I don't know how to put this. It was about as far away from the building of the house as we are from it in 1850.
From the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so basically Hepzibah realizes she's going to need to start to turn to commerce because she's running out of money, especially because Clifford is going to be getting out of prison.
Yep.
And coming back to stay with her. So she opens up this shop, which Hawthorne says was started by a previous ancestor on down on his luck as well, and then was basically bolted up, and now she's bringing it back to life. What I found interesting about it was, this is a book very much about the past, but Hawthorne also talks a lot about the modernizing and sort of symbols and tokens of modernity. And we see a couple in this in the description of the shop here.
The brown scales, too, had evidently undergone rigid discipline in an unavailing effort to rub off the rust, which, alas, had eaten through and through their substance. Neither was the little old shop any longer empty of merchantable goods. A curious eye, privileged to take an account of stock and investigate behind the counter, would have discovered a barrel. Yea, two or three barrels, and half ditto, one containing flour, another apples, and a third perhaps Indian meal. There was likewise a square box of pine wood full of soap in bars, also another of the same size in which were tallow candles, 10 to the pound. A small stock of brown sugar, some white beans and split peas, and a few other commodities of low price, and such as are constantly in demand, made up the bulkier portion of the merchandise. It might have been taken for a ghostly or phantasmagoric reflection of the old shopkeeper Pynchon's shabbily provided shelves, save that some of the articles were of a description and outward form which could hardly have been known in his day. For instance, there was a glass pickle jar filled with fragments of Gibraltar rock. Not indeed splinters of the veritable stone foundation of the famous fortress, but bits of delectable candy, neatly done up in white paper. Jim Crow, moreover, was seen executing his world-renowned dance in gingerbread. A party of leaden dragoons were galloping along one of the shelves in equipments and uniform of modern cut, and there were some sugar figures with no strong resemblance to the humanity of any epoch, but less unsatisfactorily representing our own fashions than those of 100 years ago.
We'll just stop that one there. Were you aware before this, or how aware were you before this, that Jim Crow, the phrase, actually came from a dance?
Did not know that.
So I think I had like maybe a faint awareness just based off of clicking on Wikipedia before.
Mm-hmm.
I was fairly unaware until I had read this book sometime last year by a guy named Leroy Ashby. And it's called With Amusement for All, A History of American Pop Culture Since 1830. And right from 1830, where they start is, he starts with the Jumping Jim Crow dance and blackface minstrelsy, and talks a little bit about how that became such a popular mass culture phenomenon. And basically, it starts off talking about this guy, Daddy Rice, who is basically... Daddy Rice is sort of the what Eminem is to rap. He is to the Jim Crow dance. Basically, it was a dance by slaves that mimicked a sort of Crow type of thing. And he saw it, or he said he was taught by some stable hand or something like that. And which is much better for the story, right? Yeah, I was taught by the best Jim Crow dancer.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he went on tour with it.
He's like an Alan Lomax of his time.
Oh, who's Alan Lomax?
This guy went into the South recording all these folk songs in like the 30s and 40s for like the first person to like really document kind of undocumented folk culture.
Yeah, except this wasn't documenting it. This is just like...
Yeah. Well, it's his of his time, which is like... Lomax, this like, is mine now.
If Lomax like performed them...
Yeah. I wrote these.
Yeah, these are mine.
The rise in the 1830s of blackface minstrel acts as mass entertainment in the United States very much reflected the influence of economic change, social class, and the growth of mixed-race amusements on the margins of the burgeoning commercial society. The Dockside area, where minstrelsy first thrived in New York City, was heavily working class and included a considerable mixing of blacks and whites. Similarly, in western frontier river towns such as Louisville, Cincinnati, and Pittsburgh, black and white laborers mingled and observed each other on and off the job. When Daddy Rice brought to New York City's Bowery area the little dance that he had watched the black stable hand performing in Louisville, he provided an instance in American commercial culture of an outland form exported to the northeastern city, as the historian Eric Lott has written. Generations later, minstrel critics would attack the racist caricatures and messages of minstrelsy. But blackface performances initially contained more complex and ambiguous meanings as well. As racial hybrids, the spreading minstrel acts attested, however unconsciously, to black influences on whites, and at the same time provided a way for lower class groups to mock social elites. Such was certainly the case in the rough-and-tumble, impoverished southeastern section of Lower Manhattan, which fronted New York City's East River. Around areas such as the Catherine Street Market, where T.D. Rice was born and raised, laborers battled economic hardship, harsh working conditions, and disease. By the early 19th century, a large proportion of New York City's 9,000 blacks, constituting around 8% of the city's population, lived and worked there, mixing with poor whites and forming what a historian has described as an urban shadowland or subversive landscape, where prostitution, drinking, and gambling flourished. Here, quite literally, was a marginal world occupying the edges of the nation's fastest-growing commercial city. While some of the racial intermingling was intimate, much of it was informal, casual, part of a daily give-and-take that accomplished residing, working, and playing in close proximity. An 1840 raid on a New York City gambling house found some 20 people of all sizes and colors. The apparent master of ceremonies was an out-and-out darkie, while off to one side, a little black rascal of 12 years, assisted by two little white ones of 11 or under, were roaring a love song. Elsewhere in the room, whites and blacks applauded a black man who was jumping Jim Crow. Black dancers, whether jumping Jim Crow or dancing for eels in street competition, constituted a common sight in and around the Catherine Street Market. A number of them came from Long Island, where slavery continued to exist until 1827, to engage in a jig or breakdown, recalled a white butcher, Thomas DeVoe. According to DeVoe, each had his particular shingle brought with him as part of his stock in trade. While a companion beat time with a heel or by striking a hand against a leg, the dancer performed on the board for monetary or other rewards, such as fish and eels. Another observer could well have been Micah Hawkins, a white man who owned a grocery store nearby, and in 1815 wrote an early blackface song. Sometimes, black fiddle players provided the backdrop for electrifying breakdown contests, featuring the popular Bubba Link Bob or the legendary Juba, William Henry Lane, who reportedly had no equal. Lane, from Lower Manhattan, dazzled Charles Dickens when the famed English novelist watched him perform in a seedy underground dance hall.
Yeah, so a few things to note on there. The way that that crime reporting, like, it was led by a darkie and there was some white ones that... The crime reporting from this time is a huge setter of racial stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into it much later, but with a book, The Quaker City by George Lippard, he was a crime writer himself before he wrote novels. And you can see it in his physical descriptions, like there's sort of dwelling on sorts of like boils on noses and just like the physiognomy of, they're just obsessed with it back then. And also, who wrote it was a bit more problematic in his crime reporting was, Walt Whitman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, both of them, I think learned from, I have an essay that I'm sort of reading that talks about how they sort of evolved over time, but that was a dominant cultural type was these sort of crime reports, which is very tied in very closely with sort of escaped slave advertising and that sort of stuff. And that was, it wasn't just the Federalist and Common Sense.
Yeah.
Right. Like we, I made this point on Majority Report, but you know, the common thing when, Trump's doing his like, crimes by illegal aliens.gov sort of shit. Yeah. Everyone makes the Nazi comparisons and that's good. And people should make those, but we did that shit here too.
Like, oh yeah. Like, well, it's like, I was thinking that language and people are like, you know, everyone who comes across the border is a criminal because they broke the law.
Yeah.
Which is like, yeah, like, why would you catch a fugitive slave? Like, they're literally a criminal. Like, yeah. If they're willing to run away from a plantation, what else would they do?
Yeah, and the point to make, while it's still true, because who knows how long that will be, but they're breaking the law with the same, like, sort of legal severity as speeding. So
jaywalking.
Yeah, so, like, you should be maybe we should just arrest and book everyone and separate them from their kids. Or maybe the race, the racialized aspect of the crime is why you're so fucking freaked out about it.
I don't know.
It's nice to have a podcast where you don't have to worry about like being fair to some, like let's say someone who might support the wall,
right?
Like, you know, you're just fucking wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
If you don't,
oh no, this isn't for you. Yeah, you this should, is like, not, log like, off.
Yeah, you. I'm amazed you got this far.
just imagine someone's been listening for hours, being like, oh well, I'm.
Yeah,
I can see I'm not wanted here.
We can agree to disagree.
Yeah.
The other thing is so with these Jim Crow cookies, it's fascinating to me as just a register and why Hawthorne would include that as a symbol of modernity.
Well, yeah, it was almost like I couldn't tell if it was like a confirmation bias as a reader being like, this is a really weird thing to highlight, and then to see it over and over and over again.
Because it's one of the main things she sells.
Yeah.
A little boy.
It's the only thing that it really identifies with. The only other object they talk about is something that she doesn't have, which is flour.
Yeah. Well, she loses her marbles too.
Oh, right. That's right.
There's a few other things.
No, I didn't remember that.
But as far as like, yeah, like, and this little boy comes repeatedly and they call, the narrator calls him a cannibal for continuing to eat these Jim Crow dancing cookies.
He bites the head off.
Yeah. And it's just, it's so, I don't know. So the other times race comes into this is there's the Italian, another, and this, and he's also mentioned as a sign of modernity, is the Italian with his monkey and the organ grinder.
Yes.
And he shows up twice on the streets in front of the house, again as a sign of modernity, and also the theme of commerce is with him because he's doing that for money, and the monkey is just really out there trying to get money out of people's pockets. And then there is sort of an actual black person, but it's in the narrative of a Holgrave that we've alluded to earlier, that Holgrave, who we're going to meet shortly, is the daguerreotypist, another symbol, a sign of modernity. He's a daguerreotypist that lives in the House of Seven Gables as a lodger for Hepzibah.
Yeah.
And he's telling a story of, to Phoebe, who we've not met yet, about a story that he sort of concocted about Pynchonian mythology and like what could happen with the family. And it's unclear how much is true and how much isn't. Oh yeah. And in that story, because it's set in an earlier time, it's mentioned that there is a slave, a black slave who does have a speaking role, working in the House of the Seven Gables. And those are the only times race is really involved, but all sort of indicators of time, like the slave is sort of there to show like times past, I think, a little bit, and then like the Italian influence, again, racialized modernity and time,
and that is not white while this is being written.
No, definitely not. Yeah,
an Italian is nothing even close to an Anglo-Saxon at that point.
Yeah.
I couldn't help but feel, reading this section talking about this, so the kid, he runs up to the House of Seven Gables, which is now a store to him. Immediately, he sees the storefront and he's like, "This house that's been here forever is nothing. You know, it's this store. So I'm going to run up. I'm going to buy this Jim Crow cookie." Eats it immediately, comes back and gets another.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to check, but I feel like this comes up nearly at the exact same point in the book, where in Scarlet Letter, when in the customs house, the author pulls out the Scarlet A from its hiding place or whatever. And you see these two symbols. One is the Jim Crow cookie, easily devoured and then easily replaced. Essentially doesn't mean anything except for like some sort of immediate pleasure for a child.
Right.
And then the Scarlet A has something that has this transcendent power that you can feel the heat on it through time. And you can see, I can't tell if that, in my mind, this connection's there, and Hawthorne is showing how manufactured the world's become since the era of the Scarlet Letter.
Yeah.
That now the things that we make are disposable and they're for children, basically.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, here we'll meet Holgrave. He comes in to basically give Hepzibah a pep talk. Hepzibah is not happy that she has to turn to commerce. The narrator's tone toward her is derisory, making fun of her when he's like, "We don't mean to be so ludicrous," when she drops her marbles and has to, literally loses her marbles.
Yeah. Got her. Nailed
and,
her.
And then Holgrave, the daguerreotypist, and for those who don't know what daguerreotype is, it's an early sort of photography where you basically use light. It took a long time. It's this sort of thing where you have to sit there for hours to get your daguerreotype taken.
It's really only used for portraiture and architecture, interestingly enough, the two symbols that this book happens to be obsessed with.
Yeah, that's true. Interesting.
But never. I wish I were dead and in the old family tomb with all my forefathers. With my father and my mother and my sister. Yes, and with my brother, who had far better find me there than here. The world is too chill and hard, and I am too old and too feeble and too hopeless.
Ah, believe me, Miss Hepzibah, said the young man quietly. These feelings will not trouble you any longer after you are once fairly in the midst of your enterprise. They are unavoidable at this moment, standing as you do on the outer verge of your long seclusion, and peopling the world with ugly shapes, which you will soon find to be as unreal as the giants and ogres of a child's storybook. I find nothing so singular in life as that everything appears to lose its substance the instant one actually grapples with it. So it will be with what you think so terrible.
Now, that part harkens back to Hawthorne's obsession with the sort of twilight meaning sort of, we talked about it in the Custom House introduction. His favorite time is when it's moonlit and the sort of moonlight makes things look a bit unnatural. That quote of everything starts to lose its grasp the moment you start to deal with it is, I think, a concept that I'm sort of fascinated by. I felt that way about certain things, like learning how to podcast, for instance. Things that or play guitar, things that look before you know how to do them, like, and I don't know if this is exactly what he's getting at, but that look so imposing, but when you know how to do it, it becomes a sort of work, just normal part of your life, I guess. And it's also the thing with, I think status is the same way. Like, I have a cousin who plays minor league baseball, and everyone's for the Baltimore Orioles. And you know, I talked to him about like when people are super proud of you because you've achieved something, and it is a sort of status thing, but you become used to it immediately. Like
yeah.
you have no, the actual having and making it a part of you, it has much less substance than it did before in a certain way, at least imaginatively.
Mm-hmm.
Before you've actually accomplished it. I don't know.
Yeah, I like that. It's a good mission statement for his fiction, that none of these objects that play such an important role, whether it's the Maypole or the Scarlet Letter or the House of the Seven Gables, they don't have a direct allegory. They're not X is this. Mm-hmm. Rather, it's a conglomerate of different things that shift and change over time.
Right.
And the idea that once, like, if it's almost like he's pleading with the reader to be like, don't make me try to nail it down because that ruins it, essentially.
And he might be right about that in a certain way.
Yeah, I think any good writer, any like writer of good fiction would probably agree with that, basically.
But I am a woman, said Hepzibah piteously. I was going to say a lady, but I consider that as past.
Well, no matter if it be past, answered the artist, a strange gleam of half-hidden sarcasm flashing through the kindliness of his manner. Let it go. You are the better without it. I speak frankly, my dear Miss Pynchon, for are we not friends? I look upon this as one of the fortunate days of your life. It ends an epoch and begins one. Hitherto the life-blood has been gradually chilling in your veins as you sat aloof within your circle of gentility, while the rest of the world was fighting out its battle with one kind of necessity or another. Henceforth you will at least have the sense of healthy and natural effort for a purpose, and of lending your strength, be it great or small, to the united struggle of mankind. This is success, all the success that anybody meets with. It is natural enough, Mr. Holgrave, that you should have ideas like these, rejoined Hepzibah, drawing up her gaunt figure with slightly offended dignity. You are a man, a young man, and brought up, I suppose, as almost everybody is nowadays, with a view to seeking your fortune. But I was born a lady, and have always lived one, no matter what the narrowness of means, always a lady. But I was not born a gentleman. Neither have I lived like one, said Holgrave, slightly smiling. So, my dear madam, you will hardly expect me to sympathize with sensibilities of this kind. Though, unless I deceive myself, I have some imperfect comprehension of them. These names of gentleman and lady had a meaning in the past history of the world, and conferred privileges, desirable or otherwise, on those entitled to bear them. In the present, and still more in the future condition of society, they imply not privilege, but restriction. These are new notions, said the old gentlewoman, shaking her head. I shall never understand them. Neither do I wish it. We will cease to speak of them, then, replied the artist, with a friendlier smile than his last one, and I will leave you to feel whether it is not better to be a true woman than a lady. Do you really think, Miss Hepzibah, that any lady of your family has ever done a more heroic thing since this house was built than you are performing in it today? Never. And if the Pynchons had always acted so nobly, I doubt whether an old Wizard Maul's anathema, of which you told me once, would have had much weight with Providence against them.
Ah, no, no, said Hepzibah, not displeased at this allusion to the somber dignity of an inherited curse. If old Maul's ghost or a descendant of his could see me behind the counter today, he would call it the fulfillment of his worst wishes. But I thank you for your kindness, Mr. Holgrave, and will do my utmost to be a good shopkeeper.
Pray do, said Holgrave, and let me have the pleasure of being your first customer. I am about taking a walk to the seashore before going to my rooms, where I misuse heaven's blessed sunshine by tracing out human features through its agency. A few of those biscuits dipped in seawater will be just what I need for breakfast. What is the price of half a dozen?
Let me be a lady a moment longer, replied Hepzibah,
with a manner of antique stateliness to which a melancholy smile lent a kind of grace. She put the biscuits into his hand, but rejected the compensation. A Pynchon must not, at all events, under her forefather's roof, receive money for a morsel of bread from her only friend.
So another thing with Holgrave is, it's interesting that his first scene is him encouraging her commerce, which is, I think, another thing that, like, commerce is now, we're at a point in history where that's conservative, I feel like.
Yeah.
And where this time it's sort of, there is something, especially with regards to like sort of feudal and as like, you know, a lady, it was more subversive at the time. And now we don't really do aristocracy. I mean, well, in this country, at least.
Kleptocracy.
It's sort of a neo aristocracy where it's like political families and massive inheritances.
Mm-hmm. You see this new religion has taken over Salem, and that's the religion of commerce and activity that America becomes enthralled with for the rest of the 19th century.
And
it couldn't be a starker contrast to, it's almost like Hepzibah is the last Puritan, that this movement at the height of its power could execute any of its people that dared step out of order. And now 200 years later, it's in a sunken, miserable house that used to be the center of the world.
Right.
And this asshole artist is the new, like, evangelical, but it's for work, for getting out there and being whoever you want to be, essentially, for money.
Yeah, and Holgrave, he does have a lot of jobs, he mentions when he's bragging to Phoebe, who now, after this point, Phoebe arrives from the country to stay with Hepzibah. She's not expecting it, and she's worried because Hepzibah's also expecting Clifford to return. But Phoebe and Hepzibah sort of get along. Phoebe, by the way, is derived from Phoebos, which is Greek for light.
Yeah.
So, which is definitely intentional when it comes to, say, whole graves daguerreotypy. Daguerreotypy is 100% reliant on light. The house of the Seven Gables is repeatedly described as dark. With
almost creates darkness.
Yeah, like they're like chiaroscuro. I think is Hawthorne is conscious of that. I think it's in some of his letters talks about, you know, darkening to make the shadows more intense or whatever. That history or art history stuff. But here we have Hepzibah talking to Phoebe about Holgrave.
The old lady began to talk about the daguerreotypist, whom, as he seemed to be a well-meaning and orderly young man, and in narrow circumstances, she had permitted to take up his residence in one of the Seven Gables. But on seeing more of Mr. Holgrave, she hardly knew what to make of him. He had the strangest companions imaginable. Men with long beards and dressed in linen blouses and other such newfangled and ill-fitting garments. Reformers, temperance lecturers, and all manner of cross-looking philanthropists. Community men and come-outers, as Hepzibah believed, who acknowledged no law and ate no solid food, but lived on the scent of other people's cookery and turned up their noses at the fair. As for the daguerreotypist, she had read a paragraph in a penny paper the other day, accusing him of making a speech full of wild and disorganizing matter at a meeting of his banditti-like associates. For her own part, she had reason to believe that he practiced animal magnetism, and if such things were in fashion nowadays, should be apt to suspect him of studying the black art up there in his lonesome chamber. "But dear cousin," said Phoebe, "if the young man is so dangerous, why do you let him stay? If he does nothing worse, he may set the house on fire." "Why, sometimes," answered Hepzibah, "I have seriously made it a question whether I ought not to send him away. But with all his oddities, he is a quiet kind of person, and has such a way of taking hold of one's mind that without exactly liking him, for I don't know enough of the young man, I should be sorry to lose sight of him entirely."
I couldn't help but feel reading the description, the author's asides on the daguerreotypist, Holgrave, that there isn't some light prodding that Hawthorne is doing with his transcendentalist friends, particularly Emerson.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like the way Holgrave speechifies sometimes is you could lift it from like the his early essays or something that Hawthorne and Emerson were friends, but they didn't necessarily agree on most things, on how the world operates.
Right.
And that kind of like almost religious reverence towards action and activity can save you. I think Hawthorne thought was the most dubious.
And there's no way, even in the fictional universe that we're Hepzibah live in, where any circle that she describes like that of political reformers would not involve transcendentalist types,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and like abolitionists, exactly, abolitionists. They don't care about law and order.
They want to upend everything just to do it.
But what's interesting about it is, though Hepzibah has these concerns, she still wants him around.
Yeah.
Which is a sort of self-hating aristocracy thing, I think. Like, she understands the sort of need for this sort of thing, or like the justice of it, or she's drawn to it somehow, at least.
Yeah, there's some magnetism there that she doesn't understand, which is going to be, that's a theme with all these characters. They're going to see things about each other that they don't really know why, but they are drawn to each other.
Yeah, especially with Holgrave, and mesmerism is basically like the 18th century stand-in for witchcraft. And that literally comes up in the fictional story that Holgrave tells Phoebe. In chapter 6, basically, Phoebe's out in the garden, and Holgrave comes and smooth talks his way, says, "Hey, that chicken sure likes you. And by the way, take a look at these pictures."
Yeah, look what I just did.
And she's like, oh, and she assumes that it's a picture of the old ancestor, Colonel Pynchon, that's in the painting. But in fact, it's above the current Judge Jaffrey Pynchon, and they look a lot alike. And Hawthorne mentions how, you know, isn't that weird how that happens over the course of time? Because it is true that, you know, a few generations out, you have a lot of different ancestors you could look like.
Mm-hmm.
So that you would look like a couple, it is sort of spooky.
I think Jaffrey is the great grandson of Colonel Pidgeon at that point.
Okay.
So pretty far out.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so now basically Clifford or Holgrave and Phoebe meet, get along fairly well. And then Clifford comes. Clifford has a very weird intro. We'll describe it here before getting into him. This is how Clifford enters the book.
Poor Clifford. Poor Clifford.
Thus murmuring in an undertone, as if speaking rather to her own heart than to Phoebe, the old gentlewoman stepped on tiptoe about the room, making such arrangements as suggested themselves at the crisis. Meanwhile, there was a step in the passageway above stairs. Phoebe recognized it as the same which had passed upward as through her dream in the night-time. The approaching guest, whoever it might be, appeared to pause at the head of the staircase. He paused twice or thrice in the descent. He paused again at the foot. Each time the delay seemed to be without purpose, but rather from a forgetfulness of the purpose which had set him in motion, or as if the person's feet came involuntarily to a standstill because the motive power was too feeble to sustain his progress. Finally, he made a long pause at the threshold of the parlor. He took hold of the knob of the door, then loosened his grasp without opening it. Hepzibah, her hands convulsively clasped, stood gazing at the entrance. "Dear Cousin Hepzibah, pray don't look so," said Phoebe, trembling, for her cousin's emotion and this mysteriously reluctant step made her feel as if a ghost were coming into the room. "You really frighten me. Is something awful going to happen?" "Hush!" whispered Hepzibah. "Be cheerful. Whatever may happen, be nothing but cheerful." The final pause at the threshold proved so long that Hepzibah, unable to endure the suspense, rushed forward, threw open the door, and led in the stranger by the hand.
Yeah, that is such a weird and like almost hilarious entrance.
Yeah.
To be like waiting for a new guest that you heard come late in the evening to come downstairs, and he like literally steps or stops halfway down the stairs a couple of times.
Yeah.
That's a weird thing to do.
Yeah.
You don't ever do that. That's sort of like an automatic track that you're on. Once you've started stairs, you usually finish those
stairs.
It's
not a terminus point at all. You're definitely trying to get somewhere.
And then he stops at the threshold, grabs it. I mean, the story is he's been in prison for 30 years.
Presumably in solitary confinement.
Yeah.
So he may have gone insane, basically.
Yeah, and the thing is I've seen in one essay he's described as a proto-Wildean, like Oscar Wilde, a proto-Oscar Wildean aesthete.
Oh, that's interesting.
Sybarite is the word they use in the book here, but he's basically like he just wants beautiful and nice things.
Yeah,
and he hears the bell that is used for Hepzibah to. For the store to determine when people have entered, and he hates that. He gets very angry, and he loves like butterflies and hummingbirds and things like that.
Well, even in his own personal relationships, he doesn't really like. He tolerates his own sister. There is like love there, but it's an aesthetically painful experience for him
because
his sister's so ugly. Whereas Phoebe. Is a young, beautiful woman, and it's not necessarily like a sexual attraction, but it's just like an aesthetic experience. It's far sweeter to him than to see his own old sister.
Yeah, Hawthorne makes a point. He really bangs on that point. Like, first, that Hepzibah has this awful scowl that she's basically developed over the course of the past 30 years, and also that thank God Phoebe's here because Clifford will have some eye candy, basically.
Yeah.
Like, literally. That's
Nothing beyond just the visual pleasure of it, though.
Yeah, because she's the light.
And
a lot of feminist writing has sort of taken...
They've ruined this, too, if you can believe that.
Yeah, they just can't let us enjoy Phoebe for what she is. Why does she have to be some feminazi? but she is just sort of this cipher for like the light and healing powers and goodness, basically, and naiveness.
She's got to be my least favorite character or the least fleshed out character of the whole crew.
Yeah.
There's no internality with her.
No.
She's like a butterfly that can talk.
Yeah, she's like, her basic arc is she can't believe that Like, say, Judge Pynchon isn't as upstanding as he ought be based on, like, society's expectations for him.
Mm-hmm. But and she then, intuits something right away when she meets
she
him.
She does. She recoils from his attempted kiss.
Yeah.
But she doesn't really know why, and then later she sort of knows why, but then she has to be sort of snapped out of it by Holgrave. But anyway, we're going to, before we get to Judge Jaffrey Pynchon, who comes after Clifford arrives shortly and asks to see him. That's that point where he meets Phoebe and tries to give her a kiss, and she instinctively recoils. And then he tries to force his way in to see Clifford, and he's turned back by Hepzibah.
And he's brought up earlier also because the novel is trying to solve this question of, like, well, is the whole family poor, or is it just them? And it seems like just Hepzibah and Clifford are at, like, the butt end of this family that's still kind of doing well. Mm-hmm. And so there's, like, reference, like, why won't you get your cousin Jaffrey Pynchon to take some of his money? And you don't know why, but Hepzibah continues to be like, I will never take any of his money.
Right. Yep, exactly. But before that, let's meet another character, Uncle Venner, who's sort of like the local. He makes his rounds getting sort of leftovers and stuff. But he stops in to Hepzibah to give her some advice on commerce and opening a store. He's sort of like he's a sort of all-around trader sort of guy, I guess.
He's almost like this, like, Old Testament figure who's been alive for, like, hundreds of years.
Yeah, when I mentioned earlier, like, you can almost view every character as sort of supernatural.
Yeah.
Hawthorne specifically mentions that, like, we don't know if he was ever young, but he was at least younger.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was a nice touch. Because yeah. This whole time you get descriptions of Clifford and Hepzibah's age, and I don't know if they're necessarily, like, octogenarians or anything, but they seem like they're within like 10 years of dying possibly.
Mm-hmm.
And then this Uncle Veneer comes and he's like significantly older than them. He has memories of Hepzibah as like an infant. Mm-hmm. So he has to be at least like 20 years older than them.
Yeah. He comes around and he has some interesting theories about property that we should focus in on.
She talked kindly to the vagrant artist, and took sage counsel, lady as she was, with the wood sawyer, the messenger of everybody's petty errands, the patched philosopher, and Uncle Venner, who had studied the world in street corners and other posts equally well adapted for just observation, was as ready to give out his wisdom as a town pump to give water.
For a second. For when I was first reading that, I was like, he was as ready to give out his advice like a town pump. I thought they meant like the town prostitute for a second. Like, he's willing, like, prostitute his opinions everywhere. So I was like, that's much more bold than I thought he was going to do.
No, in fact, he has a short story called The Town Pump that tells the story of a town from the vantage point of the town water pump. I haven't read it.
Yeah, that... If we skip that one, I would.
He likes to do that thing. He also has one called like the Old rocking Man's chair. Yeah,
yeah. I've read that one. That's trash.
Came over on the Arabella. Yeah,
yeah.
It was like kids stuff, right?
Yeah, it's for babies.
Yeah. I should say this is when they're all gathered around in the garden. There's sort of like a motley crew of weirdos.
This is like the best part of the book. I feel like I love this idea of this family where they're all kind of, some of them are related and some are not, but it's like, they're just freaks. It's like, or this like land of misfit toys, and they're all coalescing pretty well.
In the Cambridge Companion to Hawthorne, the Seven Gables essay is around queerness.
Mm.
The term queer is actually very interesting, and some people like Brett Weinstein in the intellectual dark web crowd might call this oppression studies.
Yeah.
But it's actually very interesting and tied to important things like production, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like queerness originally, one of the original terms of it was for counterfeit. So these are like, this is a queer coin or queer, it's not a perfect reproduction, right? And then also another reason why sort of not, the basic thing is not whether you're a homosexual and that makes you queer, right? Queerness is basically, especially in sort of, I guess, a Marxist critical technique, is your relationship to traditional modes of production. So like the family unit, right?
Yeah.
Like the, and that's obviously changed over the course of American history. You get the more atomized family in the 20th century, but the 19th, like you... These are all, none of these characters are reproducing. Well, Judge Pynchon had a wife that
he hated.
That died. Apparently, he made make him breakfast on the honeymoon.
Yeah.
Not very happy marriage. Hepzibah, it's unclear what her romantic life is, if she doesn't really have one, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
You'd have to assume that she hasn't had a run-in with anyone she's not related
to. Like, Venner makes some hints that, hey, you can come out to my farm, but... She seems kind of like uninterested in that stuff.
Yeah. I thought she said she might go out there and he's like, don't. It's like a dump. Like, I was almost like, is he homeless or what's his deal?
Oh, I didn't know about that.
I could be confused on that. Yeah. I thought someone was saying that his place is so bad that you wouldn't even want to go see it.
No, he's actually, I know Venner's pretty happy about it. Clifford thinks he'll do something else. Actually, we'll get to that here.
Miss Hepzibah, ma'am. Said he once, after they had all been cheerful together. I really enjoy these quiet little meetings of a Sabbath afternoon. They're very much like what I expect to have after I retire to my farm. Uncle Venner, observed Clifford in a drowsy inward tone, is always talking about his farm, but I have a better scheme for him by and by. We shall see. Mr. Clifford Pynchon, said the man of patches, you may scheme for me as much as you please, but I am not going to give up this one scheme of my own, even if I never bring it really to pass. It does seem to me that men make a wonderful mistake in trying to heap up property upon property. If I had done so, I should feel as if Providence was not bound to take care of me, and at all events the city wouldn't be. I'm one of those people who think that infinity is big enough for us all, and eternity long enough. Why, so they are, Uncle Venner, remarked Phoebe, after a pause, for she had been trying to fathom the profundity and appositeness of this concluding apothegm. But for this short life of ours, one would like a house and a moderate garden spot of one's own. It appears to me, said the daguerreotypist, smiling, that Uncle Venner has the principles of Fourier at the bottom of his wisdom, only they have not quite so much distinctness in his mind as in that of the systematizing Frenchman. Come, Phoebe, said Hepzibah, it is time to bring the currants.
The part about infinity being big enough for all of us is sort of a... friendly political sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
But when read into the context of let slavery wear itself out,
yeah,
is you start to see where the limits of that sort of...
Well, it's kind of like, it's like a much more poetic way of that, like, non-aggression principle or whatever that libertarians live and die by. Well, they don't do either of those things because they don't practice it.
Yeah, no.
Shit. But that whole thing,
they're
like,
detached from reality.
Yeah, like, wouldn't it be better if we all, if no one, you know, whatever, was it stole someone else's labor or whatever? And it's like, I guess if we didn't live in a world of mass production, we all were able to survive off of like the fruits and the nuts of the forest.
That was maybe belonging to the Native Americans.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. Still, even in that moment, it's still taking from someone else.
There's no moment of, there's no prelapsarian libertarian moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we're saying his Uncle Venner would be on like Alex Jones today, basically. Yeah.
It's funny, right after Holgrave drops the Charles Fourier reference, who is a French utopian socialist pre-Marx, Hepzibah calls Phoebe like, okay, let's go to the kitchen.
I think we've heard just about enough.
I have a bit of I wasn't terribly familiar with Charles Fourier. So I went to YouTube, which is becoming a more and more reliable place to research some sort of left-wing history sort of stuff. And this is from a YouTuber named Robert King, and he has a summary. He's got a video on the Utopian Socialists I'll link to in the description, and here's a short summary of Charles Fourier.
The second utopian socialist we see here is Charles Fourier, and he was a more mystical type, a rival of Saint-Simon, who began to argue that selling goods in the free market and in a market economy often involve lying and deception. Fourier himself, with his father's help and encouragement, began a business in the French city of Lyon, which quickly failed. And after this business failure, Fourier spent his entire life preparing a scheme to improve the condition of humanity. Fourier, too, believed, like Saint-Simon, that history moved in cycles and that history was moving ever progressively towards mankind's discovery, that is, becoming conscious or aware, mankind's discovery of the principles of cooperation and harmony. And once man discovered or became aware of these principles, humankind, I should say, would be free from the repression that bourgeoisie middle-class society represented and forced upon individuals. So Fourier proposed in his scheme, and this is really one of the crackpot ideas, this idea of communities of 1,620 people, very exact, called phalanxes, and that these phalanxes would channel human passions into socially productive work. And therefore, we see this idea of the community called the phalanx channeling individual passions to produce something that would be the social good, and that would lead to the spirit of cooperation. So individuals would not be pursuing their own self-interest and the accumulation of individual wealth, but they would be pursuing the idea of a better community. And Fourier, again, interesting story, kind of sat in his apartment, writing and writing and writing and refining his schemes, waiting for people, that is men of means, to show up at his doorstep with a check in hand to finance his phalanxes. And I think you can guess, nobody showed up. So Fourier, an interesting case study. As
you know, Patreon.com/Fourier if you want to support
still
his.
Still waiting, just a skeleton with a little cup.
1,600. I mean, 1,620, that sounds like a decent little community.
Yeah, you can. Someone can give that up.
Sorry to any of the Fourier heads out there if that wasn't a fair representation of your guy.
Yeah. Just DM Matt if there's a problem with it.
Any sort of leftist sort of arcana and we want to quibble over with, just tweet at me. Okay, so now let's move to chapter 11, which is one of the more interesting chapters. It's called The Arched Window. A lot happens in here. It's basically tired of going to the garden with Clifford, Phoebe's sort of been breathing life into, or shining life into, I guess. They go up to this window that sort of overlooks the street, and Clifford sees a number of things from that window that really sort of overloads his sensitivities. One of them being the Italian boy with the monkey and the organ grinder. And he sort of freaks out because the monkey is sort of scares him. But it's also because it's looking for any sort of thing out of people's pockets. Clifford and the narrator sort of assist this connection of everybody's doing that. Like, that's what America sort of is. It's money grubbing. We're all money grubbing monkeys, basically. And Clifford, in his sort of overly sense, gets sort of freaked out by it. He also sees a parade, a political parade, and it's one of the more, and I won't play from that. But it's very interesting section to read. The metaphor is basically, from this arched window, this is aristocracy looking down on the people, on the public. And it's especially apparent in the description of the parade, because the narrator writes that from up close, or if you were looking at it from a door on street level, the parade is not that impressive. Mm-hmm. Because you're seeing just individuals and in all of their grotesqueries, basically. But from above, from a mansion, giant mansion window, it looks something different, and you see the entire mass of humanity sort of melting into one. And Clifford wants to basically jump into it.
Yeah.
It's sort of it's a little bit unclear, but basically it looks like he wants to jump and commit suicide. And Phoebe and Hepzibah have to hold him from going out the window. And when they successfully are able to do that, he says, "Well, I might have been a different man if I survived that." And it's sort of like he wants to join humanity, but it's just unclear how that's he can possibly do that from his position.
Yeah. Yeah, he is enamored with the fluid state of man at that time. And we already saw how Hepzibah feels about fluidity, especially with identity, which is I'm a lady. You know, it's like her comfort comes from having a concrete role in life, and it just happens to be one of prestige.
Right.
And but she doesn't always feel that way, because she's also like, this place is a prison. And Clifford only sees the prison, and he sees all this activity buzzing outside, you know, especially someone who's literally been in a prison. The idea of having a fixed identity is probably sickening to him.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So the clip I did pull from this section goes back to our very, sort of our favorite game, which is old fun entertainments.
I flagged it.
Yeah. Too, so, yeah. This is the second time soap bubbles have made an appearance, at least.
Ominously.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. Soap bubbles, man. Fuck.
Yeah.
They're like the, I don't know what the metaphor is, but I don't know what they represent in modern day. But if you remember in Hope Leslie, they're blowing soap bubbles before the massacre at Bethel.
Yep.
And this time, Clifford is up blowing bubbles from the arch window. And this is where, for the first time in this podcast, not in the story, we'll meet Judge Jaffrey Pynchon.
Thus, lingering always so near his childhood, he had sympathies with children and kept his heart the fresher thereby, like a reservoir into which rivulets were pouring not far from the fountainhead. Though prevented by a subtle sense of propriety from desiring to associate with them, he loved few things better than to look out of the arched window and see a little girl driving her hoop along the sidewalk, or schoolboys at a game of ball. Their voices, also, were very pleasant to him, heard at a distance, all swarming and intermingling together as flies do in a sunny room. Clifford would doubtless have been glad to share their sports. One afternoon he was seized with an irresistible desire to blow soap bubbles, an amusement, as Hepzibah told Phoebe apart, that had been a favorite one with her brother when they were both children. Behold him, therefore, at the arched window, with an earthen pipe in his mouth. Behold him with his gray hair and a wan, unreal smile over his countenance, where still hovered a beautiful grace, which his worst enemy must have acknowledged to be spiritual and immortal, since it had survived so long. Behold him, scattering airy spheres abroad, from the window into the street. Little impalpable worlds were those soap bubbles, with the big world depicted in hues bright as imagination on the nothing of their surface. It was curious to see how the passers-by regarded these brilliant fantasies as they came floating down and made the dull atmosphere imaginative about them. Some stopped to gaze, and perhaps carried a pleasant recollection of the bubbles onward as far as the street corner. Some looked angrily upward, as if poor Clifford wronged them by setting an image of beauty afloat so near their dusty pathway. A great many put out their fingers or their walking sticks to touch withal, and were perversely gratified, no doubt, when the bubble, with all its pictured earth and sky scene, vanished as if it had never been. At length, just as an elderly gentleman of very dignified presence happened to be passing, a large bubble sailed majestically down and burst right against his nose.
Before we figure out who that dignified gentleman was, it occurs to me that, and I didn't before listening to this time, that he's viewing bubbles as another medium of communication almost, or reproduction, or like a mirror of the world. He mentions twice there that people see the reflection of the world in these little bubbles, and it's just kind of fun. It doesn't really mean anything. It's going to disappear in a little bit. But for that brief time, that reflection is joyful to people, which I don't know if it's like tweets or something. I'm trying to think of like what that sort of like the sort of aristocratic condescension, like, oh, this is me connecting with the people on the street
mm-hmm.
through this little fun thing. And but it's so fleeting. There's no substance to it.
It's like the pleasure of the object is tied up intrinsically with its destruction, that it, that the fact that it can't last is what makes it so sweet to enjoy for a second, but it doesn't give it grave importance like the passing of life or something. Rather, it only adds to its frivolousness.
Yeah, it's like Snapchat.
That's it.
He looked up at first with a stern, keen glance, which penetrated at once into the obscurity behind the arched window. Then with a smile, which might be conceived as diffusing a dog day's sultriness for the space of several yards around him. "Aha! Cousin Clifford!" cried Judge Pynchon. "What, still blowing soap bubbles?" The tone seemed as if meant to be kind and soothing, but yet had a bitterness of sarcasm in it. As for Clifford, an absolute palsy of fear came over him.
So once again, Judge Pynchon described, we haven't played it before, but he's always described as appearing one way and sort of, but that maybe not comports with how people sort of are interpreting his present actions.
Well, it's interesting also because he, unless I'm confused about the family tree, he's the leading patriarch.
Yep.
And, but yeah, he doesn't live in the,
well, he has a country house.
So that like adds to his duplicity. Like he's leading this royal lineage, but in a way that ingratiates him into society in a much better way. Like he even goes by like judge. Like he has a job that's his identity.
Right.
So he's found a way to graft on like the power of the Pynchon family and adapt it into modernity. And then he left the husk behind for his coattail cousins.
Right. And he's described basically, I mean, we've already talked about how he looks the same. He also carries a staff mm-hmm. and sort of, a lot of his
he's a dandy.
Comportment. Well, before we get back to him, though, let's go to this section with Holgrave and Phoebe, where Holgrave really is in one of his moods, his revolutionary moods. And this is one of them. Holgrave is such an interesting character to me. I named a horse after him on Red Dead Redemption.
That's going to be a story from your childhood rather than from your PlayStation.
Yeah, no. I mean, that's how, if I do a create a player of you in NBA 2K, that means you're a really good kid. Hepzibah is like, she's like 6 foot, but she's very fat. let's get to this. This is a chapter 12 where we see some of Holgrave's politics.
But had you peeped at them through the chinks of the garden fence, the young man's earnestness and heightened color might have led you to suppose that he was making love to the young girl.
I love that little aside by the narrator that's like, he's so verbose in his like, in explaining his worldview that it almost would mistake him for like that he's making love with Phoebe. I can't remember who said it, but there's this line of like, beware any man who writes you poetry if he's like your lover, because he is probably in love with poetry and not you, basically.
Oh, interesting.
And just like there's like a certain kind of person that's so in love with themselves and their ideas that you could almost be mistaken for like having sex.
Right.
At length, something was said by Holgrave that made it apposite for Phoebe to inquire what had first brought him acquainted with her cousin Hepzibah, and why he now chose to lodge in the desolate old Pynchon house. Without directly answering her, he turned from the future, which had heretofore been the theme of his discourse, and began to speak of the influences of the past. One subject, indeed, is but the reverberation of the other. "Shall we never, never get rid of this past?" cried he, keeping up the earnest tone of his preceding conversation. "It lies upon the present like a giant's dead body. In fact, the case is just as if a young giant were compelled to waste all his strength in carrying about the corpse of the old giant, his grandfather, who died a long while ago, and only needs to be decently buried. Just think a moment, and it will startle you to see what slaves we are to bygone times, to death, if we give the matter the right word. But I do not see it," observed Phoebe. "For example, then," continued Holgrave, "a dead man, if he happened to have made a will, disposes of wealth no longer his own. or if he die intestate, it is distributed in accordance with the notions of men much longer dead than he. A dead man sits on all our judgment seats, and living judges do but search out and repeat his decisions. We read in dead men's books. We laugh at dead men's jokes and cry at dead men's pathos. We are sick of dead men's diseases, physical and moral, and die of the same remedies with which dead doctors killed their patients. We worship the living deity according to dead men's forms and creeds. Whatever we seek to do of our own free motion, a dead man's icy hand obstructs us. Turn our eyes to what point we may, a dead man's white, immitigable face encounters them and freezes our very heart. And we must be dead ourselves before we can begin to have our proper influence on our own world, which will then be no longer our world, but the world of another generation, with which we shall have no shadow of a right to interfere. I ought to have said, too, that we live in dead men's houses, as, for instance, in this of the Seven Gables. And why not, said Phoebe, so long as we can be comfortable in them. But we shall live to see the day, I trust, went on the artist, when no man shall build his house for posterity. Why should he? He might just as reasonably order a durable set of clothes, leather, or gutta-percha, or whatever else lasts longest, so that his great-grandchildren should have the benefit of them and cut precisely the same figure in the world that he himself does. If each generation were allowed and expected to build its own houses, that single change, comparatively unimportant in itself, would imply almost every reform which society is now suffering for. I doubt whether even our public edifices, our capital, state houses, court houses, city hall, and churches ought to be built of such permanent materials as stone or brick. It were better that they should crumble to ruin once in 20 years or thereabouts, as a hint to the people to examine into and reform the institutions which they symbolize. How you hate everything old, said Phoebe in dismay.
So I think that's maybe a bit more extreme than I'd even be. I think you can leave buildings up for longer than 20 years. But it is, as a expression of sort of political frustration at a time where the main issue is slavery, right?
Yeah, I think mobility, the this character is concerned about is, you know, not being fenced in and things like that. And I think even, like, you could say, like, social and religious tradition, like the idea of, like, maybe even, like, rebelling against the the nuclear family and things like that, that he's so disgusted that he has to be fixed to these norms that were created by people who aren't there. And I know I touched on this earlier, but it really is a much more verbose description of the Jeffersonian philosophy, like in his famous letter to Madison, where he's like, my philosophy is that the world belongs to the living,
right,
and that the dead have no claim over us. And that it's quite a beautiful phrase, but he literally did believe this, like this idea of, like, the Constitution should be torn up every 40 years or so,
right,
that no one should inherit property. He's like, that's the only way we're gonna break free from the world. Like, when he's talking about a revolutionary act, he's like, this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
it's not the revolutionary ability to accumulate capital, it's this ability to not have any social, like, norm that Europe had, basically.
Mm. Yeah, and which is, that is the admirable part of that philosophy, I think.
Yeah,
definitely. And one that you wish maybe stuck a bit more.
Yeah, I guess you see this character kind of at the tail end of that. Like, there's different ideas that he's going through in this diatribe, and you can see an early republicanism breaking through this kind of haunted version of Jeffersonian democracy or Jeffersonian Democrat. This is like a contradiction of forms that's weaving in and out of his kind of verbiage, and it's after this novel comes out, but this type of person is going to end up in the revolutionary Republican ranks in about 9 years, basically.
Yeah, exactly. You think Holgrave?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, not based on the ending, the specific ending to this, which we'll get to later.
That's true.
Which he becomes.
Well, yeah. I guess the person who would give this speech, assuming nothing supernatural were to happen,
yes,
to them,
exactly, yeah,
that they would end
assuming
up.
Assuming he wasn't a wizard.
Yeah, yeah. They'd be burning down Atlanta. And
which,
like,
that's not a spoiler. That it's all unclear.
I think it's pretty clear that he's a wizard.
Well, he could be a wizard. Let's go to now. Let's go back to Jaffrey. This is where this is the not the first time Jaffrey freaks out, but it's him once again trying to come talk to Clifford. And
why does he want to talk to Clifford?
He just needs to see his brother or his cousin.
Yeah, did you know that feeling when you just have to see your cousin you haven't seen in 30 years?
Yeah, exactly. And your other cousin doesn't want you to see the cousin.
Yeah, like, yeah. Begs you not
to. Cousin, damn it, you bitch!
I love him. I just love him so much.
And so yeah, so this is and Clifford's like, how dare you, Hepzibah? Think I want to see him for any sort of not good reason?
It's good gaslighting.
And Hepzibah loses her cool with that.
Try Jaffrey Pynchon, and you shall find him true to the heart's core. In the name of heaven, cried Hepzibah, provoked only to intenser indignation by this outgush of the inestimable tenderness of a stern nature. In God's name, who you insult, and whose power I could almost question, since he hears you utter so many false words without palsying your tongue, give over, I beseech you, this loathsome pretense of affection for your victim. You hate him. Say so like a man. You cherish at this moment some black purpose against him in your heart. Speak it out at once, or if you hoped so to promote it better, hide it till you can triumph in its success. But never speak again of your love for my poor brother. I cannot bear it. It will drive me beyond a woman's decency. It will drive me mad. Forbear. Not another word. It will make me spurn you. For once Hepzibah's wrath had given her courage. She had spoken. But after all, was this unconquerable distrust of Judge Pynchon's integrity, and this utter denial, apparently, of his claim to stand in the ring of human sympathies, were they founded in any just perception of his character, or merely the offspring of a woman's unreasonable prejudice deduced from nothing? The judge, beyond all question, was a man of eminent respectability. The church acknowledged it, the state acknowledged it, it was denied by nobody. In all the very extensive sphere of those who knew him, whether in his public or private capacities, there was not an individual, except Hepzibah and some lawless mystic like the daguerreotypist, and possibly a few political opponents, who would have dreamed of seriously disputing his claim to a high and honorable place in the world's regard. Nor, we must do him the further justice to say, did Judge Pynchon himself probably entertain many or very frequent doubts that his enviable reputation accorded with his deserts. His conscience, therefore, usually considered the surest witness to a man's integrity, his conscience, unless it might be for the little space of 5 minutes in the 24 hours, or now and then some black day in the whole year's circle, his conscience bore an accordant testimony with the world's laudatory voice. And yet, strong as this evidence may seem to be, we should hesitate to peril our own conscience on the assertion that the judge and the consenting world were right, and that poor Hepzibah, with her solitary prejudice, was wrong. Hidden from mankind, forgotten by himself or buried so deeply under a sculptured and ornamented pile of ostentatious deeds that his daily life could take no note of it, there may have lurked some evil and unsightly thing. Nay, we could almost venture to say further that a daily guilt might have been acted by him, continually renewed and reddening forth afresh, like the miraculous bloodstain of a murder, without his necessarily and at every moment being aware of it. Men of strong minds, great force of character, and a hard texture of the sensibilities are very capable of falling into mistakes of this kind. They are ordinarily men to whom forms are of paramount importance. Their field of action lies among the external phenomena of life. They possess vast ability in grasping and arranging and appropriating to themselves the big, heavy, solid unrealities such as gold, landed estate, offices of trust and emolument, and public honors. With these materials, and with deeds of goodly aspect done in the public eye, an individual of this class builds up, as it were, a tall and stately edifice, which in the view of other people, and ultimately in his own view, is no other than the man's character, or the man himself, Behold, therefore, a palace. Its splendid halls and suites of spacious apartments are floored with a mosaic work of costly marbles. Its windows, the whole height of each room, admit the sunshine through the most transparent of plate glass. Its high cornices are gilded and its ceilings gorgeously painted, and a lofty dome through which, from the central pavement, you may gaze up to the sky, as with no obstructing medium between, surmounts the whole. With what fairer and nobler emblem could any man desire to shadow forth his character? Ah, but in some low and obscure nook, some narrow closet on the ground floor, shut, locked, and bolted, and the key flung away, or beneath the marble pavement in a stagnant water puddle with the richest pattern of mosaic work above, may lie a corpse, half decayed and still decaying, and diffusing its death scent all through the palace.
Yes, that was a bit of an extended section, but I thought the description of how powerful people sort of build up, even to themselves, a sort of deniability about maybe means to the end. Mm-hmm. And, like, I mean, obviously Trump is an example. The whole... That family has just been built upon tax fraud, basically.
Oh yeah.
But even not just Trump. Like, you look into any one of these families. Like, you look into the Kennedys, right?
Basically, anyone who's successful at that level.
Yeah, LBJ. I mean, literally stole elections. Both Kennedy and Nixon are great examples of this. Like Kennedy was. Kennedy probably won because of stuffed ballots in Illinois, but the reason Nixon couldn't challenge is because they were stuffing ballot boxes too, right?
Yeah.
Like, so it's like, this is all, and
now I think it was Nixon's deep love of norms.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, this would tear the country. Well, that's what he said in his,
yeah, of course,
in his, like,
let me just, you know, go talk to Vietnam real quick, yeah, and upend peace process.
In one of his dozen memoirs, he's like, I couldn't do that to the country.
Yeah.
It's
not what we do as Quakers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. Quakers. But so, yeah, Jaffrey, it's interesting there. Hepzibah, the distinction between how he's received in his private life versus his personal life is very huge. Now, how much should we spoil? Basically, he comes to see Clifford.
I think go for it.
Yeah, let's just go for it. If you wanted to read this book, spoiler free, you should stop this podcast right now and go listen to it. But
stop it, become a member, and then read the book.
Stop it, patreon.com/literary hangover, and then. But basically, so Clifford comes, is like, I need you, Hepzibah, to go get Clifford. Because I know he knows where the papers for the colonial lands are. And Hepzibah's like, I think you're crazy, but I'll go see him. Hepzibah goes through the house. It's very spooky, definite haunted house vibes going on. She can't find him for a while. She eventually goes back to, like, Judge Pynchon to tell him that Clifford's missing. And she sees Clifford outside the door pointing into the room that Judge Pynchon's in, and he's sort of laughing. At first, Hepzibah thinks he's pointing to something invisible. She doesn't quite see what he's pointing at. And it turns out, this isn't explicit in the book, but he's pointing at Judge Pynchon's body, because Judge Pynchon died in that moment. They decide, like, let's get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
And so they take a train ride. And this chapter, it's called
Flight of the Two Owls.
The Flight of the Two Owls. It's my favorite chapter in this book.
Can you imagine if it ended right there? Like, with them on the train. I think I remember reading, my first time reading it, being like, this is it. Like,
yeah,
this should be the end of it. Instead of that kind of, like, tying all the bows together.
Very strange ending.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But also liberatory, and I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, no, I know what you're saying. But then we'd miss the chapter which we've sort of alluded to coyly earlier, where...
Okay, that's the last
chapter. It's an entire chapter of just Judge Pynchon's body and the narrator being like, why aren't you going to your meeting? Why aren't you buying that new horse you wanted to buy? Why aren't you going to the insurance office? You're just sitting there. Get up, you lazy bones.
You want to talk about that now? have a lot to say about it, but it's like it does go. So yeah, the whole chapter is it's the narrator addressing the dead body of Geoffrey Pynchon sitting in the colonel's chair.
Yeah, overnight and like through a day, I think.
Yeah, it's rotting, yeah. And it goes way beyond, in my opinion, the part of like because you can, it, there's this veneer of like a parable of like what we spend our life doing and all these things to keep busy and how it's all for naught because we're all going to die. Very, very traditional sentiment. It goes on so long that it goes beyond that. It's like, this is an allegory for someone that Hawthorne knows personally.
Yeah.
This is some sort of psychotic revenge fantasy that's going on. Like imagining your enemies dead and laughing over their corpse. Cause he, as the writer, he killed him. And now the writer is like, I'm glad you're dead. You're a piece of shit and all this stuff. It's so strange.
It's not. It's called, the chapter is called Governor Pynchon, and he's he's not ever called governor. He's not. He never becomes governor. He dies before he can go meet with the people who could help make him governor.
Yeah,
like it is. It's so nasty.
Yeah,
it's it ends. I mean, it's like you're just sitting there. You could be doing all this like important stuff, and goes through his like sort of social calendar, and then it ends with a fly on his eyeball.
Yeah.
And he's like, can't even brush that fly away, huh?
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I'm going to leave you then.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, I'm going to find the actual line. Yeah, it's called Governor Pynchon, so 322. Yeah, okay, here it is. And there we see a fly, one of your common house flies, such as they are always buzzing on the window pane, which has smelt out Governor Pynchon, and alights now on his forehead, now on his chin, and now, heaven help us, is creeping over the bridge of his nose toward the would-be chief magistrate's wide-open eyes. Canst thou not brush away the fly? Art thou too sluggish? Thou man, thou hadst so many busy projects yesterday. Art thou too weak? Thou wast so powerful? Not brush away a fly? Nay, then we give thee up. Like, damn, man.
Yeah. Got him.
But so while his body is sitting there rotting, we get Hepzibah and Clifford. They're like, let's make a fucking run for it. Doesn't really make sense, which Holgrave notes later.
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily a run for it, but it's there's something liberatory about the master of the house is dead. Like the house of Pynchon.
It's like anarchy.
Yeah, it's like, and they're the last ones. There's Phoebe, but Phoebe didn't even know she was a Pynchon until they told her, pretty much, or what that means. She knew her last name,
right?
She wasn't a lady by any means. So it's like the past dies in like that moment, and they're just people with the name that happens to be Pynchon. It's like, well, we can do anything now.
All right, so here is the flight of the two owls, and they meet the man on the train and try to go through that whole process.
The conductor now applied for their tickets, and Clifford, who had made himself the purse-bearer, put a banknote into his hand, as he had observed others do. "For the lady and yourself?" asked the conductor. "And how far?" "As far as that will carry us," said Clifford. "It is no great matter. We are riding for pleasure, merely."
"You choose a strange day for it, sir," remarked a gimlet-eyed old gentleman on the other side of the car, looking at Clifford and his companion as if curious to make them out. "The best chance of pleasure in an easterly rain, I take it, is in a man's own house, with a nice little fire in the chimney."
"I cannot precisely agree with you," said Clifford, courteously bowing to the old gentleman, and at once taking up the clue of conversation which the latter had proffered. "It had just occurred to me, on the contrary, that this admirable invention of the railroad, with the vast and inevitable improvements to be looked for, both as to speed and convenience, is destined to do away with those stale ideas of home and fireside, and substitute something better."
"In the name of common sense," asked the old gentleman, rather testily, "what can be better for a man than his own parlour and chimney-corner?"
"These things have not the merit which many good people attribute to them," replied Clifford. "They may be said in few and pithy words to have ill-served a poor purpose. My impression is that our wonderfully increased and still increasing facilities of locomotion are destined to bring us round again to the nomadic state. You are aware, my dear sir, you must have observed it in your own experience, that all human progress is in a circle, or to use a more accurate and beautiful figure, in an ascending spiral curve.
while we fancy ourselves going straight forward and attaining at every step an entirely new position of affairs, we do actually return to something long ago tried and abandoned, but which we now find etherealized, refined, and perfected to its ideal. The past is but a coarse and sensual prophecy of the present and the future. To apply this truth to the topic now under discussion, in the early epochs of our race, men dwelt in temporary huts of bowers of branches as easily constructed as a bird's nest, and which they built, if it should be called building, when such sweet homes of a summer solstice.
We'll fade out a little bit there, because this is basically what this chapter is, him going on and on to this train driver, or like a ticket agent or whatever he is. And the guy getting more and more sort of bewildered by his theorizing. But I think we can say safely that Clifford would have been an Elon Musk fan.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say he like outlined Hegel's dialectic pretty well. The idea of like existence is this ascending spiral that gets more and more perfected through a dialectic between the old and the new.
Yeah.
He got it.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's interesting that a book so tied to like property. This is maybe a bit of a digression, but transportation is a huge part of that too. Yeah. One of the big, maybe insuperable problems I haven't seen a big solution for with regards to climate change in this country is how do we deal with the fact that we've been building suburbs that are extremely inefficient in terms, like especially compared to grids,
right,
in terms of car travel, like they're like these wavy, long, giant, like communities that. With like multiple cul-de-sacs and like, mm-hmm, it just doesn't make sense in a world where you're trying to make where like driving in a car is bad actually.
Yeah.
But like that drawing the connection of we have trains now, so why do we need fireplaces? And like, I think of like the fireplace is basically just that's what the plasma TV was before we got those, right? Like, everyone gathers around it. It's sort of stimulating.
Yeah.
Like, that's the stimulus center of the home. I mean, mm-hmm, fire still kicks. Like, if you've ever been around a fire, it's at least as good as a plasma screen TV. Like,
yeah.
To watch flames.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You never get sick of that shit. And you get marshmallows. Like, it's fire.
The original old-timey enjoyment is, yeah, fire.
Fire, exactly. Fire, you can't really top it. It's so much fun. And we're not big enough and we don't have enough kids listening so we can say things like this. Fire is awesome.
Yeah.
Like lighting candles, just leaving candles unattended. it's fun.
Letting a firecracker go off in your hand, all these things. Well, I like this because it's, you realize that the world that the daguerreotypist is describing, the one with no fixed places, it's the train. Mm. They get on the train. This is a permanent spot that you can sit on that's never in one place. It's built, but it's not set.
Yeah, and trains had a huge psychological impact on people.
Yeah, this is the first time. I mean, it's because usually we're talking about the 17th century, and we are talking about the 17th century in this book, but this is so steeped in the 19th century. This is, yeah, the first time we're talking about mass transportation.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So let's go on a little bit further. He has some more theorizing, and it starts talking about real estate.
My aspect belies me strangely, for a great weight being off my mind, I feel in the very heyday of my youth, with the world in my best days before me. I trust you may find it so, said the old gentleman, who seemed rather embarrassed and desirous of avoiding the observation which Clifford's wild talk drew on them both. You have my best wishes for it. For heaven's sake, dear Clifford, be quiet, whispered his sister. They will think you mad. Be quiet yourself, Hepzibah, returned her brother. No matter what they think, I'm not mad. For the first time in 30 years, my thoughts gush up and find words ready for them. I must talk, and I will. He turned again towards the old gentleman and renewed the conversation. Yes, my dear sir, said he, it is my firm belief and hope that these terms of roof and hearthstone, which have so long been held to embody something sacred, are soon to pass out of man's daily use and be forgotten. Just imagine for a moment how much of human evil will crumble away with this one change. What we call real estate, the solid ground to build a house on, is the broad foundation on which nearly all the guilt of this world rests.
A man will commit almost any wrong. He will heap up an immense pile of wickedness as hard as granite, and which will weigh as heavily upon his soul to eternal ages, only to build a great gloomy dark-chambered mansion for himself to die in, and for his posterity to be miserable in. He lays his own dead corpse beneath the underpinning, as one may say, and hangs his frowning picture on the wall, and after thus converting himself into an evil destiny, expects his remotest great-grandchildren to be happy there. I do not speak wildly. I have just such a house in my mind's eye.
Then, sir, said the old gentleman, getting anxious to drop the subject, you are not to blame for leaving it.
He probably could have guessed he had a specific one in mind.
Yeah, that I know.
Doesn't seem very general.
It's almost, yeah, it's like, well, it's not a metaphor. You're just talking about your life.
Yeah, like, and then they have a sister who has a gross skull on her face. Yeah.
But a lovely niece.
Within the lifetime of a child already born, Clifford went on, all of this will be done away. The world is growing too ethereal and spiritual to bear these enormities a great while longer. To me, though for a considerable period of time I have lived chiefly in retirement and no less of such things than most men, even to me the harbingers of a better era are unmistakable. Mesmerism, now, will that effect nothing, think you, towards purging away the grossness out of human life?
All a humbug, growled the old gentleman.
These rapping spirits that little Phoebe told us of the other day, said Clifford, what are these but the messengers of the spiritual world knocking at the door of substance, and it shall be flung wide open.
A humbug again, cried the old gentleman, growing more and more testy at these glimpses of Clifford's metaphysics. I should like to rap with a good stick on the empty pates of the dolts who circulate such nonsense.
Then there is electricity.
So first, it's interesting how he goes from spiritual nonsense, basically, to technology and how tied those were together in the imagination.
The demon, the angel, the mighty physical power, the all-pervading intelligence, exclaimed Clifford. Is that a humbug, too? Is it a fact, or have I dreamt it, that by means of electricity, the world of matter has become a great nerve vibrating thousands of miles in a breathless point of time? Rather, the round globe is a vast head, a brain, instinct with intelligence. Or shall we say, it is itself a thought, nothing but thought, and no longer the substance which we deemed it.
If you mean the telegraph, said the old gentleman, glancing his eye towards its wire alongside the rail track, it is an excellent thing. That is, of course, if the speculators in cotton and politics don't get possession of it. A great thing indeed, sir, particularly as regards the detection of bank robbers and murderers.
I don't quite like it in that point of view, replied Clifford.
A bank robber, and what you call a murderer likewise, has his rights, which men of enlightened humanity and conscience should regard in so much the more liberal spirit, because the bulk of society is prone to controvert their existence. An almost spiritual medium like the electric telegraph should be concentrated to high, deep, joyful, and holy missions. Lovers, day by day, hour by hour, if so often moved to it, might send their heart-throbs from Maine to Florida with some such words as these. I love you forever. My heart runs over with love. I love you more than I can. And again, at the next message, I have lived an hour longer and love you twice as much. Or when a good man has departed, his distant friend should be conscious.
So yeah, as a media studies master's student, that part really appeals to me because it reminds me... do you have anything to say about that?
You know, we've been in this world of we've been in the Puritan head for like a very long time on this podcast and what it means and what they want and there's something so moving about because they kind of fade out Puritans they got beaten by their kind of overplayed their hand a little bit and
the witch trial was not very good on them
Hawthorne finds a way to give them like a meaningful coda, like as an idea or as people with ideas that there's these kind of freaks that are not in their own time because they're the last gasp of this ancient order of people that saw things that wanted to make the world new and had this Calvinist idea that everything has its proper place and that we focus on the thing about like you're damned before you're born, and that's a very That's a very fucked up theology, but the idea that like the life is a drama and it's about how you play your part correctly, that it gives this beautiful summation of what the Puritan project would be in this kind of raving lunatic on a train going cross country, that he can kind of see past the veil of reality and give Puritanism its more than it probably deserves in this last one before it gets fully subsumed and taken over by consumer capitalist culture.
Right.
I don't know. There's something like that's the ending. It doesn't, that Puritanism in America doesn't deserve, but it's a beautiful ending that Hawthorne has kind of given this little button on something that he cares deeply about.
Yeah. And I see in that context why, like, if this was the final chapter, that would be an interesting way to have ended it. Like,
yeah.
On the train surrounded by the telegraph. It reminds me of this Henry David Thoreau quote about the telegraph. It's sort of famous. "We are in a great haste to construct a magnetic telegraph from Maine to Texas. But Maine and Texas, it may be, have nothing important to communicate. We are eager to tunnel under the Atlantic and bring the old world some weeks nearer to the new. But perchance the first news that will leak through into the broad flapping American ear will be that Princess Adelaide has the whooping cough." And it's like, good. It's interesting because it's a sort of Luddite-ish quote. Well, in the context of not like in technology, not in the sort of labor champion context, mm-hmm. But you know, he's right and wrong in certain ways, right? Like, there's very little as important to a current time, especially lately, as the communications technology that it's using and who controls that. It's very interesting to me that the train conductor's first response is as long as the financial and slave interests, was it, don't get a hold of it?
Government interests.
Was it?
I think. But the funny thing about that time is, you know, those are synonymous terms.
Right. Let's see here.
That is, of course, if the speculators in cotton and politics don't get possession of it.
Right, yeah, yeah. And it's funny because he mentions from Maine to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that's specifically referencing that Emerson quote.
Yeah.
But I think very interesting little chapter there towards the end. That's really the climax.
Yeah.
We'll have one final clip to play. Basically, Holgrave and Phoebe arrives back at the House of Seven Gables and finds Holgrave there with the dead bodies. Yeah. With the dead body.
Should say there's like 50 pages left. Like, there is a good chunk.
Yeah, yeah,
but
that's true.
This is like the end.
Yeah,
like emotionally and like arc wise, like this is the peak.
It's weird after this point.
It just turns into like one of those like Shakespearean, or not even. It actually reminds me of like Job, where it's such like a beautiful story about like loss, and then it's like, and then he got double everything he ever wanted, and things not only are good, they're perfect now. Right. It's like, oh God.
Yeah, and it does not seem very convincing to me. Like, that's the thing about Hawthorne as a conservative writer is in the Scarlet Letter, as a conservative writer, not to say he is one, but like if you're going to view him as one, which I think is fair, Scarlet Letter is sort of unfulfilling, and this one is unbelievable, sort of.
Well, it's like he had it, and then he let it go.
Yeah.
You had the ending, you had the denouement, and then you just are like, oh God, I got to clean this all up. It's like, no, you don't. It's messy. That's what's good about it.
Yeah, so here is, this is basically, then finally Hepzibah and Clifford return and they basically sort everything out. And in that moment where it's like, oh crap, are Hepzibah and Clifford going to be blamed for the murder?
Yeah, because there's a rumor going around town that he was murdered.
Yeah, Holgrave decides that he should propose to Phoebe. Yeah. And Phoebe's like, yeah, of course, you're the protagonist, I'm the female.
But doesn't the narrator pretty much admit, or I can't remember if Phoebe says it or the narrator says, like, they fell in love pretty much because they're the only contemporaries that in the town.
I think there's a few different hints, like oh, there's another young man, and yeah, exactly.
Like, but that's it, like, there were no other prospects, which is interesting because it's like the House of Seven Gables is in disrepair, but you don't really hear about it, but it's like the whole town may very well be in disrepair because this is Salem.
Yeah, and Salem, I mean, the high point of Salem, as we know, was around the 17 before the war.
Yeah.
In 1812, 1814.
Especially, you said it was like Jefferson's trade embargo.
Right?
They really
yeah.
blew Salem to smithereens.
Yep. So here is Holgrave saying his new plans for what he's going to do with basically now that he's the man of the house. I mean, you can't really call Clifford that, so.
Yeah, yeah.
On the day set for their departure, the principal personages of our story, including good Uncle Venner, were assembled in the parlor. "The country house is certainly a very fine one, so far as the plan goes," observed Holgrave, as the party were discussing their future arrangements. "But I wonder that the late judge, being so opulent and with a reasonable prospect of transmitting his wealth to descendants of his own, should not have felt the propriety of embodying so excellent a piece of domestic architecture in stone rather than in wood. Then every generation of the family might have altered the interior to suit its own taste and convenience, while the exterior, through the lapse of years, might have been adding venerableness to permanence, which I consider essential to the happiness of any one moment." "Why," cried Phoebe, gazing into the artist's face with infinite amazement, "how wonderfully your ideas are changed! A house of stone, indeed! It is but 2 or 3 weeks ago that you seemed to wish people to live in something as fragile and temporary as a bird's nest." "Ah, Phoebe, I told you how it would be," said the artist with a half-melancholy laugh. "You find me a conservative already. Little did I think ever to become one. It is especially unpardonable in this dwelling of so much hereditary misfortune, and under the eye of yonder portrait of a model conservative who in that very character rendered himself so long the evil destiny of his race."
Now, this isn't the first time Holgrave talks about being a conservative. In the actual proposal time, Phoebe's like, "You will make me strive to follow you where it is pathless. I cannot do so. It is not my nature. I shall sink down and perish." And Holgrave says, "Ah, Phoebe," exclaimed Holgrave with almost a sigh and a smile that was burdened with thought, "it will be far otherwise than as you forebode. The world owes all its onward impulses to men ill at ease. The happy man inevitably confines himself within ancient limits. I have a presentiment that, hereafter, it will be my lot to set out trees, to make fences, perhaps even in due time to build a house for another generation. In a word, to conform myself to laws and the peaceful practice of society. Your poise will be more powerful than any oscillating tendency of mine." And then just a little bit later... this isn't Holgrave saying this, but it's sort of a famous conservative thought that is talking about how Clifford can never really be publicly exonerated for that he was suspected of murdering old Jeffrey Pynchon,
his uncle,
because people will just make him a joke because he's like weird now and messed up. And then, so the narrator says here, the pitiable mockery of it, which the world might have been ready enough to offer, coming so long after the agony had done its utmost work, would have been fit only to provoke bitterer laughter than poor Clifford, blah, blah, blah. It is a truth, and it would be a very sad one, but for the higher hopes which it suggests, that no great mistake, I don't know what these higher hopes are, that no great mistake, whether acted or endured, in our moral sphere, is ever really set right. Time, the continual vicissitude of circumstances, and the invariable inopportunity of death render it impossible. If, after long lapse of years, the right seems to be in our power, we find no niche to set it in. The better remedy is for the sufferer to pass on and leave what he once thought his irreparable ruin far behind him.
Yeah, just get over it, basically.
Yeah, man.
It's a society. It's good for society that we don't dwell on this, whether it was a mistake or it was the justice was overzealous and it's
the best
prosecution
way is to keep it within the family.
Yeah,
and let the shitty ones die.
Yeah, pretty much.
It seems so contrary to the conclusions I would draw from the rest of this book.
Yeah, and the characters seem to espouse and succeed for espousing. It just kind of seems out of left field almost.
Yeah.
It's like there's times in this novel where there's cross currents going on, clashing of ideologies. I can't help but feel that, like, as an artist, this could be a manifestation of the struggles he was having himself. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the book's strengths, is that it's never really clear on what's going on. It's like myriad and confusing as the house itself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very strange because, like I think it is fair to call him a conservative writer, but he is drawn to the areas, and the attention he pays to the areas, like fucking inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this book is basically like a 300 and some page argument for raising the estate tax. And I mean, that's the thing is, like, with history, it's like
the House of No Estate Tax, it was originally called.
When libertarians or conservatives get upset about, you know, why do we have to bring up ancient history like the Jim Crow South or slavery and shit like that? Well, the point is because, like, a lot of these concentrations of wealth and power still exist from those days.
Yeah. All of it, actually.
Yeah. Like, this is why, like, you look what happened to, like, I mean, in the housing financial crisis, it wasn't, I mean, a lot of people of all colors were affected, different backgrounds, but black wealth especially was just wiped out.
Yeah.
And it's not because, I mean, some of it is because of, like, you know, conscious racism or, like, sort of personal biases of, you know, loan providers and shit like that. But most of it is structural because we've inherited these systems from these times. And like I've said, with regards to history in general, is the lower the estate tax is, the more history matters. Mm. Like, and I think that's not even clever or like metaphorical. That's just true. Like the more we have to indulge like a concentration of power and wealth because it has just existed for a long time, the more you have to interrogate the conditions that led to its existence and that sort of thing.
Well, it's interesting also because it's like you think about the intellectual shock troops of neoliberalism were saying that history is dead, or this is the end of history,
right?
Which has like a twofold part of it. One is that we're in a world of infinite prosperity and it doesn't matter. And the second one is it doesn't matter. Don't fucking look at it.
Yes.
which
turns out to be the real
thing
behind
it. It's like when you say about the things about, you know, like when you read the things that are, they redact stuff, you know, in like the Guantanamo diaries, and it's like all that's saying is like that's signaling for what to read or what to later. Look for when it's gone.
Exactly.
And it's like when people say it's the end of history, it's like, well, we should probably be reading history then.
Yeah. Okay. Let's start with Vietnam.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like you look at all this history and it's like, shit.
Yeah.
We not the good guys in all this, are we? Like, I mean, just the amount of different things, like what happened to like the Black Panther party, like the COINTEL FBI just assassinating leaders.
Yeah.
The drug war. Like, we're at a very strange time in American history where we actually get a full view of these different types of inheritances, like the intelligence agencies and the nuclear infrastructure. And mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it's, but yeah, so that's why I really appreciated this book a whole hell of a lot. Do you have anything else you want to say cover in this?
I don't. Are we not gonna cover like the whole like controlling people thing? I'm fine to skip it as well.
Yeah. I mean, basically,
it's Holgrave, like another hour.
Yeah, Holgrave, like he's chatting up Phoebe in the garden, and he tells them about his own story. We haven't spoiled the thing about Holgrave's real identity yet. We'll leave that and this Gervais Pynchon story, not Ricky Gervais, it's spelled G-E-R. although I would see a reproduction of this where Ricky Gervais plays a character. I think that would be
cool. I think him playing Hepzibah would be the obvious choice.
Yeah, or Hepzibah, or I know he'd be a good Clifford.
Yeah.
He's already sort of played with
problematic Clifford.
Just reprise Derek.
Yeah, it's like
Ricky, your best character ever that everybody loves.
Yeah, the one that you bet the farm on and damn, blew up in your face.
That experimentation, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, Alex, thank you once again. for reading with me and discussing this book. I appreciate you very much. At Alex Guns, A-L-E-C-K-S underscore Guns.
That's it.
If you want to help support the show, we are closing in on 150 patrons at patreon.com/literaryhangover.
What will you do when it gets to 150 as a thank you?
I will probably continue researching the next episode of this podcast. Although I do think we are getting closer to Twitch, and the Patreon subscribers will get the exclusive access to the early tests for that. I think look forward to that, folks. Do you have any ideas what you want to do next?
Yeah, I got a couple.
What are you thinking?
All right.
Just go for it.
Yeah. Well, Grace is coming back for a couple of weeks.
Okay. We're we need to finish
Hope. We got to finish Hope Leslie. But I was thinking the other day that maybe we should do an episode on Henry James's biography of Hawthorne.
Okay.
It's short.
Yeah.
And it's like you wouldn't need like a lot. And it's just a way of like if you have any like odds and ends about Hawthorne that maybe you can't find other places, just like a Hawthorne dump. I haven't read it either, but here it's pretty good.
I've read it, actually.
Oh, is it good?
It's there's some stuff for discussion in that, I think.
Well, Grace is like a Henry James expert, and obviously it's like...
Interesting.
It gets off a little bit like from what you want to talk about, but it's like, it would be...
That sounds like good members content.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. All right. Well, members, there you go. Patreon.com/literaryhangover. That's what you can look forward to. So, yeah, there you go. We have a few other things we'll cook up, but... for this edition of Literary Hangover, I'm Matt Leck. Alex, thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye, folks.